From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from the Independent Media Center in downtown Philadelphia for the Republican National Convention. Today, as police say, they could open the Holmesburg prison for overflow room for protesters. We'll look at human experimentation that took place in this prison over decades. We'll also talk about the theme of the day for the protests in the streets, and that is the prison industrial complex and death row. We'll have a debate on Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as comments from Sam Donaldson about his coverage of the death row prisoner. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy. And once again, we are broadcasting here from the Independent Media Center. And here's some of the news. A policeman pleaded innocent yesterday to attempted murder in Los Angeles, and four other officers were arraigned on conspiracy charges stemming from a probe of alleged corruption in an anti-gang unit at the police department's Rampart Station. Officer Nino Durden is charged with the 1996 shooting of Javier Ovando, 23, who was paralyzed. The judge, citing the seriousness of the charges, rejected a defense bid to lower Durden's $680,000 bail. A preliminary hearing is set for August 16th. Charges against Durden and four other officers have arisen from allegations by disgraced ex-officer Rafael Perez, who began cooperating with investigators in exchange for leniency, and unraveled one of the largest police scandals in Los Angeles history.
The European Union is calling for a U.S. moratorium on federal executions in a letter to Bill Clinton released today. The letter, dated July 12th, was released by the Embassy of France, which currently holds the EU's rotating presidency. It marked the latest sign of mounting international opposition to the practice of capital punishment in the United States. The European Union also appealed for clemency for death row prisoner Juan Raul Garza.
National Urban League President Hugh Price called on government Sunday to institute a tougher beyond any doubt standard of guilt for judges and juries in death penalty cases to ensure the innocent aren't mistakenly executed. Aside from the new burden of proof in death penalty situations, Price voiced support for affirmative action, called for a new commitment to preparing the nation's youth for high-tech employment in the new economy, and for blacks to use the nation's strong economy as a springboard to economic self-sufficiency.
Thousands of protesters led by people in wheelchairs marched on the Republican National Convention yesterday to demand economic rights for people oppressed by poverty and homelessness. The opening of the four-day convention that nominates Texas Governor George W. Bush for president also brought the first of what are expected to be days of arrests when nine people blocked a downtown intersection to put a grim political skit attacking U.S. military involvement in Latin America on. Yesterday's main event was a peaceful march for economic human rights that drew about 5,000 people to downtown Philadelphia at midday. They marched to show the face of poor people to the delegates of the Republican convention, one in five of whom are millionaires. Demonstrators represented a wide range of causes, from AIDS research to organized labor, students against sweatshops, and people with disabilities. But all agreed to march in solidarity in support of an estimated 35 million poor Americans, many who've been moved off public assistance and into the ranks of the working poor by Republican and Democratic-backed welfare reform. Some protesters underscored the point by wearing gray T-shirts emblazoned with the message, "Disappeared in America, hiding the poor."
Meanwhile, Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, one of Al Gore's possible vice presidential running mates, helped lead a Democratic attack yesterday against the Republican ticket. With the Republican National Convention touting last night the theme, "Leave No Child Behind," Harkin charged Bush and Cheney have both turned their backs on poor children. Harkin went on to say, "This Texaco ticket hears oil companies loud and clear, but when it comes to kids who can't get a fair start in life, they simply smile and nod and do nothing."
And yesterday in the Ivory Coast, security forces firing tear gas and lashing out with whips dispersed a group of demonstrators, most of them supporters of the country's main opposition politician. Hundreds of demonstrators marched toward the French embassy to leave a petition in support of comments last week by French Cooperation Minister Charles Jocelyn when they were met by soldiers and gendarmes firing tear gas. Witnesses said some demonstrators were forced to the ground and beaten with whips. About 50 protesters were arrested and several injured. Jocelyn said last week that no candidate should be artificially excluded from the country's September presidential elections. His comments infuriated government officials, who said it showed tacit French support for Ivory Coast's most prominent opposition politician.
There's profit to be made. Don't worry about fair trade. You too can participate in the global economy. Products for cheap.
Big profits you keep. Now you can compete.
Think of the sweet
benefits you'll reap. No unions in your way. They work 18 hours a day. You can force them to obey. It's the new enslavery.
Pennies a day.
They can't get away.
And when they complain
about their pain,
no one hears what they say.
We give them drugs and guns, so there's millions to imprison. Only black and poor and young ones like plantations used to be.
Three strikes, you're out.
No reasonable doubt.
Unless you got clout.
A white collar, it's out.
You're not getting out.
The police force will protect you. The media reflect you. The protesters reject you. It's the prison industry.
Prison industry. Vocals by Samsara of San Francisco. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Live from Philadelphia in Center City at the Independent Media Center, where an historic event is taking place on the second day. It is the joining together of community radio and community television to bring you Breaking with Convention, Power, Protest, and the Presidency. 5 days of collaborative coverage on public access stations around the country, as well as Dish Network Channel 9415, which is the new channel of Free Speech TV based in Boulder, Colorado. Pacifica stations and community radio stations around the country are airing us, and we are video streaming and live audio streaming on the web at our website, democracynow.org. We would love to hear from you, listeners around the world who are listening on the web. If you email us, we will read some of those emails on the air as we proceed with this program. You can email us at democracy@pacifica.org, because an election of a U.S. president affects people all over the world, thanks to globalization. That's democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we take on the first issue of this program, and that is the prison industrial complex. It is the theme today of protests that will be taking place in the streets. As some people call the military prison industrial complex, as General Colin Powell took the floor last night, the first night of the Republican National Convention. The vice presidential candidate, Dick Cheney, was there, former Secretary of Defense. The former president, President Bush, was there to see his daughter-in-law speak, Laura Bush, last night, as well as Barbara Bush. And, of course, former President Bush, Secretary of Defense, former Dick Cheney, and Colin Powell were the triumvirate that ran the Gulf War. Today, prisons. And we're going to talk about Holmesburg Prison, which is in Philadelphia, Philadelphia's largest county jail. 2 weeks ago, Democracy Now! Reported that Philadelphia Police Commissioner John Timoney was planning to jail protesters there. The Holmesburg Prison, however, is not just any prison. Holmesburg is infamous for a host of medical experiments that were conducted between the early 1950s and the mid-1970s on prisoners in exchange for a couple of bucks. These experiments range from testing products like perfumes and detergents to exposure to chemical weapons and radioisotopes. The prison is now closed, open for this week. We're joined right now by one of the people who was experimented on, as well as a man who came to the prison as a literacy teacher and ended up writing a book about what he saw scratched into the backs and arms of the prisoners. Acres of Skin is the name of the book, Human Experiments at Holmesburg Prison, a true story of abuse and exploitation in the name of medical science. Alan Hornblum, our guest, as well as Leotis Jones. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Well, can you give us a lay of the land, Alan Hornblum? When did you get to the prison?
I walked into the prison in 1971. I was a literacy teacher, and one of the first things that struck me that first day was the sight of dozens and dozens of prisoners walking around with adhesive tape and bandages on their backs and arms and chests. I couldn't imagine what that was. I didn't think the prison was that unsafe. Had there been a riot on a cell block? Had there been a fight in the yard? And the next day, I asked a guard on A block, "What's the story with all these prisoners who appear damaged?" And he says, "Oh, that's nothing. That's just experiments for the human experimentation program of University of Pennsylvania." And I was a little bit shocked and alarmed and certainly dubious about that. But everybody I asked either had no knowledge about what exactly was going on or just took it for granted that these were just innocuous perfume studies for the University of Pennsylvania. Those experiments continued for the next few years, and it always gave me a chill. But when I talked to prisoners, they said they were a little bit concerned, a little bit fearful, but it was the only way to make money in the jail, and that was their prime, if not exclusive, reason for getting involved with the experiments. I always expect that there would be a good journalist like Juan Gonzalez or somebody from the Inquirer, the Daily News, or Temple, or Penn, historian, bioethicist, who would go into that study and find out exactly what they were doing there, but it never came about, so I threw myself into it in 1993, and the result 5 years later was Acres of Skin.
Well, Leotis Jones, you were a prisoner in Holmesburg. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience? What years were you there? How you got into this program?
Well, I first entered Holmesburg Prison back in the early 60s. During the time that I was there on a low bail. And being a victim of drugs during that era, there was a lot of bridges that I burned. So one of the things that was available to us at that time was the medical testing. And one of the things that we seen it as being a vehicle to freedom, not knowing all the other hidden horrors behind that, because of the fact that we wasn't given informed consent. The only thing that we were asked is, do you want to get some money? Get on the test, harmful, no long-term illnesses, no kind of health defects. So believing in them, because they were doctors, and our feelings was that they were there to heal and not to harm, we consented to that.
When you say a ticket to freedom, what do you mean?
The money that you get from those experiments that they were performing at the time, anything from Agent Orange to herpes on down to all sorts of germ agents that they was using on the soldiers during the time of the Vietnam War. They were using on the prisoners to see what the effects was going to be and things of that sort. So the monies that we got, we would use that money to post our bail to help pay for our attorneys and things of that sort.
And
that's
how,
what I meant by
and
it.
How long were you the subject of these experiments?
Well, off and on for a period of maybe about a year. Not continuously day in and day out, but you know, I may get on one test a month or every 2 months or whatever. And when that test is over, I may get on another one. I may get on a patch study, which consisted of agents that they was placing on me. I asked them what was it that they were putting on me, and they said that it was nothing. I believed them.
And did you or any of the other men have any repercussions or after effects from the test?
Yes, we have a group known as the Experimentation Survivors, which consists of some 200 and something men, and we have about four or five women that took part in those experiments too that are still suffering from the effects of those experiments. They need follow-up medical attention, and yes, they're still suffering as a result of those tests.
Leotis Jones, tell us how they first approached you. What did they tell you they were doing?
Well, one of the things they said that, for instance, say a pill study that I took part in, we was overnight underneath Holmesburg Prison in a ward, a unit that they set up that they called the metabolic ward. And we were each given a pill. Some of us stayed down there for 72 hours, 48 hours, 24 hours. I took a pill, not knowing what it was. I asked, hey, so this is just some form of penicillin. So I took it, believing that. Right now to the day, I don't know what it was. But what I'm saying is another individual, when I asked him, what did they tell you it was? Well, they told me it was some sort of sugar pill. You know, they gave individuals different, answers for those experiments that they were performing.
What about these just incredible tic-tac-toe boards that I see drawn on the backs of men, this and photographs in Alan Hornblum's book, Acres of Skin? It's absolutely unbelievable.
Well, that's the effects of the chemicals that they were placing on individuals' back.
But the back is divided equally into sort of quadrants.
That's the way they designed it.
And what was the drawing on the back? Was this?
There's no drawing. It's the burns from the chemical that they placed on the individual back. What you're seeing there is the gall that they put over top of it, which we call the patch. That's why it was known as the patch study. We didn't know what was underneath that patch, no more than what they told us. That's why we say we wasn't given informed consent.
Alan
Amy,
Harmon.
Maybe I can illuminate a little bit on this. The doctor who initiated the program is arguably the preeminent dermatologist of our day. His name is Albert Kligman. He's a prestigious professor at the University of Pennsylvania. His specialty was dermatology. When he walked into Holmesburg in 1951 to supposedly help out with an athlete's foot problem they had at the jail, he did not see people, he did not see prisoners, he saw acres of skin, which is where I got the title. It's his own term. Automatically, instantaneously, he thought this would be a great resource for his experimental studies. He had acres of skin. These were people predominantly black, overwhelmingly poor, uneducated, unsophisticated, that were desperate for money that he could use in studies, that the administration would allow him to use, and he turned Holmesburg into the Kmart of human experimentation in the post-war period of America. Specifically, all of these patches you saw on these men were different studies that were taking place by he and his fellow dermatologists putting different things on skin. It could be deodorant, detergent, but it could run the gamut to where he was actually putting dioxin on the foreheads and backs of prisoners in the mid-1960s. He was injecting them with radioactive isotopes.
Was he working with pharmaceutical companies, with chemical manufacturers?
He was the preeminent researcher for the pharmaceutical companies in the post-war period.
So he was paid by the University of Pennsylvania and
that is correct. You
the
could say he was
companies.
he was double dipping, but he recognized early on in the 50s that this was a great way to add to his academic income. In the post-war America, the pharmaceutical companies were growing by leaps and bounds, and one of the things that they needed most desperately were test subjects. They had all of these drugs, all of these items, chemicals that they wanted tested, they needed to have tested, but what they need were test subjects. And as you know, they were using retarded children, retarded adults, hospital patients, soldiers, but the guinea pig of choice in post-war America were prisoners, and Holmesburg probably was the epitome of that syndrome.
This is an absolutely remarkable story, and we're going to continue with it. Then we're going to go to Mumia Abu-Jamal. Yes, we are in Pennsylvania. The governor, Tom Ridge, who was being his name thrown around for vice presidential candidate, signed the death warrant twice for Abu-Jamal. We are going to talk about the death penalty in this state and around the country, as today that is the topic, the issue of the day for the protesters in the streets. We're joined right now by Leotis Jones, who is one of the victims of the human experimentation that took place at Holmesburg, which has been reopened for protesters this week, if there is an overflow of arrested protesters. Also, Alan Hornblum, author of Acres of Skin. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
My country isn't free. We build our military from sea to sea. Spread like a virus blight with all our taxes' might. From cops and guards who shoot on sight to the weapons industry. Our bombs are smart and fast. Our tanks are built to last longer than schools. Behind the prison fence languish the dissidents who speak of peace and common sense. Rights over rules.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, broadcasting live from the Independent Media Center in Center City, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That's right, Pennsylvania, where the Republican National Convention enters its second day, will be on the floor again tonight, and we'll be bringing you the voices of the convention, the shadow convention, as well as the protests in the streets. Today's topic, the prison industrial complex, as we talk about the prison that the Pennsylvania or Philadelphia police commissioner said would be reopened after years that it has been closed since 1995 in case there is an overflow of arrested protesters. We're talking about Acres of Skin, human experiments at Holmesburg Prison that took place over decades. The book is by Alan Hornblum, who is a literacy teacher at Holmesburg and saw the backs of men infected, charted, being experimented on. We're also joined by Leotis Jones, one of those who was experimented on, a prisoner at Holmesburg. Leotis Jones, you testified before Congress, is that right?
Yes, back in 84, to have the experiment stopped, because we recognized that they were getting out of hand. In the very beginning, the test was a relatively simple lotion and, you know, a shampoo and stuff like that, which was more dangerous than we thought it was. But it got to the point that they became more hideous with the experiments. And we had fear that if anyone didn't do anything about it, that we would have individuals coming out of there walking backwards and not knowing where they came from and, you know, things of that sort. So out of that fear, we acted and we went to Washington and we testified to have it stopped. And we were successful, yes.
Well, Alan, the prison population in America was substantially smaller back then in the 1950s and 60s. We've had an explosion, really, of the prisoner population. We're talking 2 million prisoners now in America's penal system and about 450,000 of them on nonviolent drug offender convictions. Do you have any indications that this experimentation that we're going through a new round of this in any of America's prisons?
Well, it's a very interesting question, Juan, that you bring up, because I think we are on the cutting edge of possibly reopening the door to experimentation. And it is one that has caused some trouble in the ethical and the medical community, because the door is being opened with a very troubled population. That is one of those prisoners who have AIDS or HIV positive in the institutions. They would like to have access to the new cutting-edge drugs. Many of them are still in an experimental stage. Because the country was so seared by the experiments that were done on the Tuskegee sharecroppers, on hospital patients at Willowbrook and Fernald, the prisons such as Holmesburg and others around the country, there was a backlash in the mid and late 70s that continued through the 80s into the 90s, where we should not use incarcerated populations anymore for experimentation. But what you have now, as we move into the 21st century, a situation where there are some prisoners who feel they should have access to new drugs, experimental drugs. And it really is a very troubling one for me and a number of other people, because we feel that there were tremendous excesses and abuses that took place by the medical community in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And therefore, we are still a good bit distrusting that the medical community could do those experiments again now and still abuse people who were in there.
Specifically, what products are we talking about? I mean, people who use cosmetics, shampoo
every day. Back in the
post-war
period?
The kinds of experiments that were done.
Just about everything in your medical cabinet.
I know Retin-A for one, is that right?
Retin-A was something that doctors...
Toothpaste, shampoo, lotions.
Do we have specifics? What brands?
Hair dyes. Just about anything you can mention.
Palmolive.
Any brand name was probably tested on prisoners back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It was a very cheap, affordable way. At Holmesburg and many other prisons around the country, just about every state had at least one prison that was being used as an experimental center.
Leotis Jones, you sued.
Yes, but before we get to that, I would like to say one thing. It's one of the things that left us baffled as we came together and talked about these experiments as a group, is that when they talk about going to the animal shelter and experimenting on animals, you have the Animal Humane Society and all the rest of the world up in arms about it. But when they talk about coming into a prison where you say at least 60% of the population is untried, unsentenced, and non-convicted, you don't have nobody to say anything about it. You understand what I'm saying? And then not only that, I mean, there's a lot of things that has been taking place since then. There has been attorneys, a meeting with, or attempted to meet with individuals that's responsible for these experiments, or for leaving the men and women in the conditions that they're in now, medically, and with the problems that they're having physically. And they haven't been cooperative, and all they want is reparation. You understand what I'm saying? They want an apology from the city, from University of Pennsylvania. They want a follow-up medical treatment for those that so need it. And also, they want to be compensated for their pain and suffering. And they act just as if, well, like, hey, we ain't did nothing. But you have a United States military that can move trailers inside, the walls of Holmesburg Prison and experiment.
On that note, we do have to wrap up. Final comment. 10 seconds. Leotis
Jones. Community Assistance for Prisoners is an organization that has been designed to provide assistance for individuals that are incarcerated as well as their families. And if anyone want to reach us, they can reach us at P.O. Box 50132, Philadelphia, PA, 19132. And also, they can call us at 215 area code 227-7047. Aside from that, we've been dealing with prisoners' rights to vote. We were in court in May the 22nd, 1974, the U.S. District Court. Judge Jay Lord was a residing judge at the time, and we won the right for untried, unsentenced, and non-convicted felons to vote in any and all elections in the city of Philadelphia and the state of Pennsylvania. Right now, we're in the U.S. District Court, along with the NAACP and the Brenner's Institute of Law, and we're fighting for the convicted felon having the right to vote. There's a five-year ban. You have to be out of prison for 5 years before you can vote. And we don't see what that has to do with anything when it comes to their sentence or their crime. When the court sentenced them, they said, well, you got 5 to 10 years for whatever. And it doesn't say that you got 5 to 10 years and you can't vote until you're out of prison for 5 years. So, you know, we're getting it on. We're still rumbling. And the struggle
continues. And each state is long. Each state is different.
Well, I'm just talking about Pennsylvania.
Right?
Yes, each state is different.
Every state has different laws for voting, whether convicted felons can vote. And of course, that has been a major issue in the African-American and Latino communities, as increasing numbers of especially African-American men and Latinos are denied the right to vote. And then the politicians wonder why there is such a lower voter turnout when the reality is that many people are losing their right to vote because of one conviction or a couple of convictions in their youth.
Well, you got overcrowded additions global versus crack cocaine.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us again, Leotis Jones and Alan Hornblum. His book is Acres of Skin, Human Experiments at Holmesburg Prison. It is published by Routledge Press. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back after another song from the group Samsara, we are going to the streets where another protest, direct action, has taken place.
My country isn't free. We build our military from sea to sea. Spread like a virus blight with all our taxes' might. From cops and guards who shoot on sight to the weapons industry.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! At the Independent Media Center in downtown Philadelphia. We now go to the streets with Medea Benjamin, who is running for the Senate on the Green Party ticket in California. Medea, where are you right now?
Well, I'm in front of the Four Seasons Hotel, where there's a Brexit fundraiser for Senator Trent Lott.
This is in Philadelphia?
Yes, Republican Majority Leader, and we're out here. We just got kicked out. We were inside. We managed to get in with Miss Liberty, who's dressed up as a prostitute. And we went in with signs saying, stop selling our democracy, and who owns Trent Lott? And we have all the corporations, Lockheed Martin, Union Pacific, International Paper, AT&T, that are all sponsoring Trent Lott.
Medea, can you hear me? It's Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, hey, Juan. We threw money all over the floor, and they didn't quite like that. And we were chanting, Trent Lott, he's a corporate whore. We won't take it no more. We won't take it no more. And we got thrown out, but we're out here on the outside on public property, and they're letting us stand here with our signs and our Lady Liberty prostitute.
Well, the Four Seasons is, one of the most luxurious hotels in Philadelphia, and it's also the hotel that is housing the top money givers for the Republican Party. What was the subject of this breakfast? Just honoring Trent Lott?
Well, yes, it was just a breakfast benefit, $5,000 a pop, a little bit of a steep price for breakfast. And it's the corporate high rollers here. These are the ones giving the $250,000 donations to the party. And we got inside right with them and caused quite a stir.
Medea Benjamin, I want to thank you for being with us. I just have put on my Lott Hop hat. These were given out at an event for Trent Lott. Let's see if we can see, Juan, who it was sponsored by. I have my tote bag that says the Lott Hop. We have a little diary here that says the same thing. And it came with two cups. And on the back of our bright yellow tote bag, I'm wearing my hat, by the way, which also says the Lott Hop, we see companies like International Paper,
AT&T,
Union Pacific,
Lockheed Martin,
U.S. Public Affairs, Inc.,
and Freddie Mac,
the Bond Market Association,
and Southern Company. Energy to serve your world.
AT&T, an American Gas Association. Just one of the goodies you can get from some of the hundreds of parties that are being held in honor of different senators and congress members. Yesterday, we went into the party for Bob Barr, congress member, as well as Dan Burton, well known for the Helms-Burton Act against Cuba. This is what's happening. In fact, this is probably the main event at the Republican National Convention, since we already know who will be nominated. But we're going to continue on the issue of the day, which is the prison industrial complex, with some sounds on the issue of the death penalty. This is Democracy Now!
Pollute the air you breathe. Oh no. I only want
wanted to make a lot of money.
Well, we'll go to those sounds right now. We are joined in the studio right now by Pat Clark, who's been dealing with the death penalty for many years. We're going to go to one of the oldest organizations in the United States today, and it's the American Friends Service Committee that is based right here in Philadelphia. Pat Clark is with that organization, National Criminal Justice Representative of the AFSC. Welcome to Democracy Now! A brief thumbnail sketch of George Bush and the death penalty today.
Sure that between George Bush and his brother Jeb Bush, who's the governor of Florida, they certainly have the worst record on the death penalty in the country. George Bush has been responsible for over 138 executions during his administration. Texas leads the country in the number of death penalty executions, far exceeding the next three states combined in numbers of people that have been executed. So needless to say that Bush has been pretty horrible on this issue.
What about your work at the AFSC?
Well, as the National Criminal Justice Representative, we actually deal with more than just the death penalty, but the death penalty has been my passion for a number of years. I worked as the Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus in California for 5 years before coming here to Philadelphia. And we have focused specifically on the religious community to work on the death penalty because we feel that the religious community has been not visible, not vocal, and definitely not stepping up to the plate as far as their responsibility on this issue. The irony is that, you know, folks like George Bush and Al Gore and other folks who have been very bad on this issue consider themselves to be very religiously oriented.
What about your governor, Tom Ridge?
Oh, he's as bad as they get. He has... we haven't had any executions here that have been actually set by the governor. But his position has been one where he has definitely been in favor of the death penalty, definitely has supported the death penalty. We've had volunteer executions, if you can call them volunteer, and he's definitely been supportive of that.
Well, Pat, across the country, of course, most Americans, according to the polls, still support the death penalty, but there is an increasing reaction by many people against what has been seen, especially over the last few years, by more Americans as the unjust application of the death penalty. And so you're getting, because of the scandals over DNA testing that have arisen and all of the people being released who were on death row, at least a questioning of the fairness of the criminal justice system in meting out the death penalty, if not the actual policy of having the death penalty.
Well, we certainly have seen a major decline in support for the death penalty from 80% 2-3 years ago to about 65% nationally, and that's significant. And of course, that, like you said, that's partly because folks are beginning to recognize that the death penalty is applied not only in an unfair manner as far as who is on death row, but also beginning to understand much more that innocent people have been caught up in the system. And I think Illinois, what happened in Illinois, was a great boon for those of us who are working against the death penalty. But there's a danger there, too, because most of what's happening is that people are calling for a moratorium, stop the death penalty for a while so that we can see, you know, what's wrong with it and so forth. Our position at AFSC has always been abolish it. We should not be in the business of killing people for a number of reasons, but as a old peace and justice and religiously based organization, we just feel that morally killing is wrong.
We want to thank you very much, Pat Clark, for being with us. If people want to get in touch with the American Friends Service Committee, originally based in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, also Pennsylvania, the context being named for William Penn, who was
a famous Quaker who helped found the state and so forth. So it's really important for us that, you know, the death penalty be something that we get rid of.
Where do people call the AFSC?
You can call 215-241-7130.
One more time.
215-241-7130.
Pat Clark of the AFSC, we want to thank you very much for being with us. When we come back from our break, we bring you, I had a chance to talk to Sam Donaldson, who is here, you know, of course, for ABC News, but also doing his web work, to talk about Mumia Abu-Jamal. And then we'll be joined by a man who's not supposed to enter this state because of his activism around the death row prisoner. And we'll talk to a Time reporter who just did a piece as a kind of, well, introduction to Philadelphia for the Republican National Convention on Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
I am just an atom, and my story is seldom told. I have squandered nanoseconds on a campaign full of mumbles, such are promises. It's all rhetoric, still a proton likes electrons, and they offered me a deal, oh, I lied. In the manufactured Cold War, they told me I was the best, that I'd fight for truth and justice, and they sure loved my wave particle duality. I was naive, I agreed to speak with neutrons that were waiting in the hole. I was mighty proud, feeling several angstroms tall. Lila, 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 lila.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. On Sunday, the day before the Republican National Convention began, just walking on the convention floor, you might bump into anyone from the chair of the RNC to a senator who is just seeing what best seat he might get with his state delegation, to reporters. And I had a chance to see Sam Donaldson just making his way through the media tents. And given this week's level of activism around issues like the prison industrial complex and the death penalty, I decided to ask him about Mumia Abu-Jamal. In fact, just around the corner from the Independent Media Center, where Democracy Now! Is broadcasting from, is where Officer Daniel Faulkner was shot and killed in December of 1981. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the award-winning journalist, was accused and later convicted for the murder. He was also shot at that time. And since that time, Abu-Jamal has been vilified by some of the press, deified by many social justice activists, saying that he did not get a fair trial. We're going to take a look at his case. But first, we're going to go to the media tent, where I had a chance to talk to Sam Donaldson. We're joined on the telephone just before we go to that interaction by Clark Kissinger, who has been a longtime activist around the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was put on death row and sentenced after being convicted of the murder of Daniel Faulkner. Clark Kissinger, I understand you're in New York right now, but a sentence came down or a decision by a judge just in the last day. What happened?
Well, as you may have heard, I have been ordered to remain in my home federal court district by a judge for my participation in a demonstration for Mumia last July 3rd. And what happened the other day is that the appeal judge has refused any stay of that sentence pending my appeal.
I think we've lost Clark right now.
I'm right here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, I'm sorry.
Explain, what did the judge say?
Well, what the judge said, he sentenced myself and eight other people to a year of supervised probation. It's sort of like being a banned person in the old apartheid South Africa. We had to turn in our passports, and we had to remain in our home districts.
Clark, we're going to have to call you back because this is very bad sound on the telephone right now.
Okay.
And while we do call you back, we're going to go to an excerpt of a piece by Sam Donaldson in 2020 around Mumia Abu-Jamal, and then go to the conversation I had with him in the media tent here at the Republican National Convention. You're listening to Democracy Now! This is ABC's piece.
I'm a murderer is sacrilege. Won't you have to sing these songs? Might this be Mumia Abu-Jamal's song of freedom? Or is it rather a lesson in the power of propaganda?
Tell a lie, tell it big enough, tell it often enough, and it becomes truth. And that's just what happened in this case.
And now to Sam Donaldson on the floor of the media tent on Sunday, a conversation with the reporter who did this piece for 2020. Mr. Donaldson, quick question for you. Hi. You're coming back to Pennsylvania now, where Mumia Abu-Jamal is on death row, and you did a big profile of this case. So what are your thoughts on it today?
Well, I haven't kept up with where his appeal process is. I take it it's wending its way once again through the courts. Eventually, the courts are going to have to make the final decision. And assuming they don't overturn anything the lower courts have done all these years, he will have to pay the price for his crime.
What convinced you that he had killed a police officer?
The evidence.
Many people feel, including a number of human rights groups, that it can't be that he did not get a fair trial.
Well, you say what convinced me that he killed a police officer. I said the evidence. The question of a fair trial, I'll have to leave to the courts. We examined to the extent we could the transcript, but I think there are many more things than just looking at the transcript about the trial, the demeanor in the courtroom and all of that, and I wasn't there.
He said that you didn't give him a chance to respond, that he refused to cross the Nabet strike line, but that it wasn't fair, that he didn't have a chance to give
We repeatedly asked him for an interview. We asked him before there were any strikes. He declined our request, which is his right. I'm not complaining about that. But Abu-Jamal has had a number of times in court to make his case. He has spoken repeatedly, as you know, on the radio. I know he gave a commencement address last year. Perhaps he's done that repeatedly in the past. I haven't kept up with it. To say that the man has had no opportunity to present his case, I think, is nonsense.
Would ABC News ever run one of his commentaries or actually air his voice?
You'd have to ask the management of ABC News. I've ducked your question simply because that's one that they would have to decide. Nice to see you.
One last question.
Yes,
you said that Mumia Abu-Jamal should pay for his crime. Are you saying that he should die?
Listen to what I said. I said if the courts finally affirm the judgment, in other words, after all the appeal process, then yes, he has to pay for the crime he committed. That's the judgment. That was the verdict. That was the sentence.
And is
not
that
me saying it? It's the system.
How do you feel about the death penalty?
I'm against the death penalty. I'm against the death penalty.
So,
I've preached that for years and years and years. I'm against a lot of things. But as long as the law is on the books, I have to obey it, just like everybody else.
But do you think he should die?
I think the sentence has to be carried out if the courts so determine.
Do you think
put it any simpler than that?
What do you think of all the studies that show the level of racial discrimination within the court system, especially
terrible
when it comes
racial,
to death row cases?
Obviously. Blacks go to their death far more often than whites do for the same crimes. I think that's beyond a shadow of a doubt been established, not by statistics every time you take a look at it. And it's wrong. Do you want me to defend that? You can't defend that.
But
won't try to defend that.
But then why say that?
But if you are guilty of a crime and the courts affirm the guilt, you have to pay the penalty, regardless of what we've just discussed about the disparity between races, colors, creeds, and all of that. That has to be rooted out. But you don't get a pass simply because there has been discrimination, in my view.
But racial discrimination can mean that a person who should not
certainly
be found guilty is found guilty.
That's why the courts very carefully have to look at whether the trial was fair. Absolutely. I'm not saying they shouldn't look at whether the trial was fair.
But if the courts are racist, what do you do then?
Well, that's a problem, isn't it? But I don't think the courts are racist in totality. In totality. If you think our justice system in totality is racist, then we're all lost. Some judges, I think, probably are. Some cases, I think, probably suffer from it, absolutely. But I'm not going to second guess this one. He has had one appeal after another. He still has, Mr. Weinglass is still able to appeal the case. That's fine with me. I'm not one of those who says cut off all appeals. And at some point, there has to be a finality of the appeals, I take it. And when that point comes, if the courts affirm the judgment, I think he has to pay the price.
And that was ABC News' Sam Donaldson, who did a major piece on Mumia Abu-Jamal, as you can hear, concluding that he was guilty and should pay the price. We are joined on the telephone by C. Clark Kissinger, activist with Refuse and Resist, banned from Philadelphia for his activities in demonstration at the Liberty Bell around Mumia Abu-Jamal. And in the studio here at the Independent Media Center, Steve Lopez is with us, senior writer at Time Magazine, who recently published a piece on Mumia Abu-Jamal called Protesting the Death Penalty, Wrong Guy, Good Cause. Clark Kissinger, first, your response to Sam Donaldson and the piece he did on death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, after Sam Donaldson put that piece on the air, I wrote a critique of it, and I put 8 questions to Sam Donaldson, which he has to this day refused to answer. I asked him, did he really find it credible that a group of trained police officers would hear a public confession of guilt for the slaying of a fellow officer and that none of them would report it to anyone for 2 months? He has no answer to that. I asked him if he was really comfortable with the fact that the prosecution used 11 peremptory challenges to knock African Americans off the jury when that was declared later unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, and he had no answer to that. And I asked him, what do you think is the proper deterrent to prosecutorial misconduct if not a new trial? And again, he has not answered. And what he did do was to put another version of that same piece on the air later, in which he introduced what we have later just, you know, proven was a phony, another confession story by a guy named Philip Block. We came up with the evidence that that story had been phony, too. To this day, Sam Donaldson has yet to apologize.
I should also say, by the way, that Maureen Faulkner, I understand, from Steve Lopez of Time Magazine, is at the Republican National Convention. Is that right?
I think she's scheduled to speak at 6 this evening.
She'll be addressing the Republican.
Well, what she's going to do is read some courtroom testimony, eyewitness accounts of the shooting, along with some of her late husband's relatives.
Well, Steve, we were former colleagues sometime back in Philadelphia here. You wrote a piece recently for Time Magazine. For those of our listeners around the country who have not read it, could you tell us a little bit about what the piece said?
Well, I wrote about how I continue to be amazed by the growth of this the Free Mumia campaign. And I don't live in Philadelphia now, but I did during the time when that just fanned out around the globe, and was amazed as I began to educate myself about the details of the case as to how people could sign on to that. And when I encountered people and asked, why are you signing up for this? People in Hollywood and elsewhere, it was clear to me that many people didn't have the details of the case, and I started to write about it to sort of straighten out the record.
And what did you conclude?
Well, I concluded that Mumia probably sabotaged his own trial, and I think the most, well, for me, as I wrote in this piece, the crowning absurdity of this support is that nobody in support of him has demanded that either he or his brother, who are the only two people who know what happened that night, have explained to anybody what happened. And it's just beyond belief to me that this man sits rotting on death row and his own brother has nothing to say other than, I ain't got nothing to do with this.
C. Clark Kissinger.
Well, you know what Steve Lopez did here is what most lazy journalists do when they're writing under deadline. They run to the prosecutor, get his version of the story, and then run that out as the gospel truth. Steve writes that there were four eyewitnesses to the scene. Well, actually, there were 10 witnesses testified. Eyewitnesses to all or part of the incident had testified in the trial and in the subsequent hearings for a new trial. Two of them said Mumia was the shooter. Two of them said that another man was the shooter. Four of them testified to somebody else running away. Mumia was not removed from the courtroom because he made political speeches. He was removed because he insisted on his right to defend himself, which has been guaranteed by the Supreme Court many times. And every time he attempted to cross-examine a witness, he was removed from the courtroom. Steve tells us about the jury of 10 whites and 2 African Americans, but he doesn't tell us about the peremptory challenges, nor does he tell us that the foreman of the jury, a white man, in the voir dire process, actually said that he could not be fair in this trial. And he says that we claim that the bullet we insist that the bullet taken from Faulkner was .44 caliber. We don't insist that. That's what the medical examiner, the completely filled out, signed medical examiner's report said. That's their document, not ours. I'm just amazed that Time Magazine doesn't have any fact checkers.
This, you know, you can talk about lazy journalists. I mean, everything that you said could be quickly and easily refuted. I don't know that we have the time, but that's the problem with this case. You know, you talk about the 44 and the 38. The 44 was a preliminary report from an assistant medical examiner who did not use the proper equipment to check it and later corrected himself. You know, Mumia's defense attorney later conceded that it was consistent with the 38. But this is the kind of propaganda that keeps getting generated and regenerated. And, you know, I talked to Leonard Weinglass about the 29 claims in the latest appeal, and none of them carry much weight as far as I'm concerned.
What about his defense attorney? I think we both knew him when he was a practicing attorney in Philadelphia. Do you have any qualms about the kind of representation he got?
Well, you know, here's another thing. When I first started seeing what people said in support of Mumia, one thing was that the defense attorney was a hack who'd never handled any homicide cases. I went to meet with him and talked to him, and he said he'd handle like 20 homicide cases. And he said, look, I thought we could have put on a decent case. Mumia wanted a political trial, political theater, not a legal defense. So there were clearly some problems with this trial. And I'm sympathetic to the causes. I'm against the death penalty. I think there are too many people in prison, and it's a shame. But you heard our other guest here, and this happens frequently. He didn't respond to my central point here, which is that people in support of Mumia have nothing to say about the fact that Mumia and his brother have not explained what happened.
See, Clark.
Well, actually, we have a lot to say about that. And I think it would have been helpful to your readers if you had pointed out that no one, not even Tony Jackson, has ever been able to name any of these homicide cases that he participated in and that he was subsequently disbarred, something that you never bring up. Nor do you bring up the fact that Amnesty International did an independent study of this case and determined that the trial was a travesty and Mumia should get a new trial.
Nor do you bring up the fact when you point out that the police...
You would know why Mumia didn't testify, because he said explicitly in the last day of the penalty of the guilt phase that he was entitled to the right to represent himself, to confront and cross-examine his witnesses, and that if he was not guaranteed all of his rights, he was not going to exercise any of his rights. And if the state was so hot to put Billy Cook on the stand, they could have subpoenaed him put him there. Why don't you ask them why they didn't do that?
Does it not strike you as odd that Billy hasn't said anything in defense of his brother?
The man in the car with him.
On that note, we have to thank you both very much for being with us, Steve Lopez for Time Magazine and Clark Kissinger, activist with Refuse and Resist. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Broadcasting live from the floor of the Independent Media Center. Our producer is Jeremy Scahill, with help from Deepa Fernandez and Karen Palmer. Our technical director is Grayson Challenger. We had assistance from Sanaz Mozafarian, David Thompson, Lisa Shaw, Nell Geiser. Video production is by Didi Halleck, Skip Blumberg, Linda Iannacone, John Hamilton, and Joe Friendly. Internet production by Prothap Chatterjee, Lynn Hoshino, and Derek Chung. Thanks to Paker Tiger Television, Deep Dish TV, and the IMC in Philadelphia. From the studios of the Independent Media Center in downtown Philadelphia, I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
You know. hash out the differences.